Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Who Inspire. I'm Cynthia Poore, and my guest today is Amy Biancalli from the Times Union, and she's here to talk about some of her articles that she's written for the Times Union and also the book she's written. So, Amy, how are you? First of all, are you surviving this pandemic and civil unrest?
As well as anybody. I mean, I'm fortunate. I have my health, and I know a lot of people have died and suffered, and that's true of both the pandemic and the police brutality. So these are crazy times we're living through, but I'm hoping it's
really
a turning point.
Oh, and the one thing I forgot to mention is that you're a musician also. Let's talk a little bit about that to start off with, about your musical ability and your band and what you do.
Oh, sure. Well, thanks for asking about it. Music keeps me sane. It's never been something that I do professionally. I spent most of my life as a very happy classical amateur violinist. Very happy, very amateur. But after my husband died 8.5 years ago, I decided I wanted to learn how to play jazz violin, and I became obsessed specifically with gypsy jazz, and I fell in with a really wonderful group of people. And I play in a band, so it's a lot of fun. It's very challenging music, but it's just impossible to be unhappy when you play it. So it's great. It's my therapy.
Unfortunately, because of the restrictions on large numbers of crowds, you're not doing it as much as you used to, right?
Oh, no. We haven't had any gigs since we did a coffee house gig at the Moon and River in Schenectady right before the shutdown in New York. We have gotten together for a few outdoor social distancing practice sessions. Like, we got together last night in a park in Del Mar and stood apart from each other. So we're starting to get back into it slowly. And I'm hoping we'll be able to do more of that, at least play outside.
I hope you do. So you work for the Times Union. How long have you been with them?
Well, in this stint, I've been there covering local arts and writing a column since late 2012. But I was there previously from early 90s. Like, I started writing for them in 91 and then left in 2000 after my youngest was born. And then by the time I left, I had morphed into a movie critic there and wound up working for the Houston Chronicle as a movie critic for several years before getting laid off there in late 2012, and miraculously bounced back to the TU because my old job opened up there with the local arts beat.
So you spent a number of years in Texas then, right?
No, not in Texas. Writing for Texas. I was still in Albany. I saw the movies in Albany. Sometimes I'd have to go down to Manhattan to see them, but mostly I saw the movies here, and I wrote from here, and I went to Houston twice, all told, in eight years of writing for them. So,
out of all of the movies that you've critiqued, what was your favorite?
Oh, my gosh. The favorite of all the movies that I reviewed?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. That's... I don't know. I had so many favorites, everything. My gosh. I don't know. I loved Moonrise Kingdom. I loved, I can't even think of them. There's so many movies I loved. I was constantly falling in love with movies, but here's the thing. when it comes to recall of movies that I saw and wrote about, I always used to describe this to people as having a very small shelf in my brain. And I because when I wrote movie reviews as my daily job, that meant that I was not only watching the movies that I was reviewing every week, which could have been anywhere from mm-hmm. one to at most four. Usually it was one or two, sometimes two or three, maybe at most four. But in addition to those movies, I would also have to do homework on movies from filmmakers I was unfamiliar with. So that meant in any given week, I was watching 5, 8, 9 movies. And so I had this shelf in my brain that accommodated maybe 8 movies. And as soon as I saw another one, as soon as I saw a new movie, like a 9th movie, it would I'd have to push it onto the shelf and then one would fall off. I would immediately, like I would write so many reviews and then most of the time just move on and forget that I had even written about them, which sounds a little strange, but that's how that worked for me cognitively at any rate. I didn't have the room in my brain.
So you've written a lot of stuff over the years and the time hearing about art. My favorite story that you wrote was when you and your sister went to see Barry Manilow. That was truly a beautiful story. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. Yeah, so my sister Betsy, she's an acquired sister because I lost my childhood family when I was in my 20s, and I had this second family. I was always close to them, but they informally adopted me, and they've been family for the last 43, 45 years of my life, more than that. Anyway, so Betsy is absolutely one of the most extraordinary human beings on the planet. She happens to be developmentally disabled, but she is as complete and wise and beautiful and creative a human being as you'll ever meet. There's nothing missing from Betsy, you know, regardless of whatever her developmental disabilities are. She's complete. And she's actually a fabulous artist. She's been making a lot of, she does crochet art, and she's been doing a ton of it. But she's a huge Barry Manilow fan. She just loves Barry Manilow. She's loved him since she was really little. And it was decided that for her birthday that I should be the one to accompany her down to Manhattan. She lives in Virginia Beach, but her late parents, our late parents, my add-on parents, lived in Vermont. And so her dad, who my dad Dan, this gets complicated. I'll just say our dad. He just died in February. And he wanted to give her a really, he knew he was dying. He had a blood cancer. And he wanted to give her a fabulous birthday. So he and his wonderful partner, Margaret, spearheaded this effort and bought tickets and for me and Betsy to go see Barry in New York City, bought the train tickets, like threw money at me to make sure that I could just splurge on her in the course of the day. And we went down there and it was absolutely one of the most memorable concerts I've ever been to. She was ecstatic. She loved every song, knew every song. I loved and knew almost every song that she loved and knew, which kind of startled me a little bit. I've never been a Barry Manilow hater, but I didn't really realize how much I loved so much of his songs until I was there just enjoying it with Betsy and singing along. And we just had absolutely the time of our lives. And afterward, we went outside and waited outside the theater to see if we could catch a glimpse of him when he came out. And we did. And that just, it made her life and it just made mine. It was just a beautiful day.
Does she still talk about it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, constantly. Yeah. Yeah. Great. She always will. Yeah, she's. I wish everybody could know Betsy. She's just she is really just a beautiful human being, and I'm blessed to have her in my life and count her as my sister.
That's nice. You also wrote a book, which I assume had to be pretty painful. Tell us a little bit about your book.
You mean the last one, the memoir of my husband's death? Yeah.
Yes.
Can I say the title on this podcast? It's got it's got a swear word in it. Yeah, it's called Figuring Shit Out, and the subtitle is Love, Laughter, Suicide, and Survival. And it's the book I wrote about the year. I actually started writing it in the middle of the year after my beautiful, late, brilliant husband, Chris Ringwald, jumped from a roof. He took his own life.
Ooh.
And, we had three kids, and at the time they were 11, 15, and 18, actually not quite 8, yeah, 18. And to say it upended my life is an understatement. I look back on it, I'm like, I'm kind of amazed I was able to write a book, but it wasn't even that I was able to write it. I had to write it. It became necessary to me. I went into it thinking I would never write about it because it was painful enough to live through it. And whenever friends asked, I would say, no. You know, because I figure, oh, Amy's a writer. I'd written another memoir about my parents and sister and their deaths over the course of 2 years. And my sister was a suicide as well. So it was logical that people would ask if I was going to write about my husband's suicide, and I would say, no. But then I just started doing it. I had written these long emails about a family adventure that the kids and I took in Ecuador, where my oldest was having a gap year. And I had written these long, kind of very chatty emails describing some of these adventures to one friend, then I emailed other friends and family, and then I just also wound up writing another story, a chapter, just for my own sanity. And and this same friend had just basically said, Amy, you should write a book. I told him I should write Adventures in Widowhood, and he goes, oh, you got to write it. And so I started writing it, and still seems miraculous to me that I managed to get it done, but it helped me.
So when you were writing it, at first, were you kind of daunted by thinking, how am I going to get this done, or how am I going to get through this?
No. You'd think I would, but no, because it felt necessary. It was an imperative. I felt like once I started writing it, I had to do it, and it became an in the moment thing. It was something I did. How do I describe this? Well, for instance, the present tense, when I was talking about things that happened to me in that moment that I was describing, like I had a really kind of comical interaction with some people at a dollar store in the neighborhood. And so when I wrote about it, I used the present tense, and I took that tack with each chapter. And the chapters are very short. They're like these short, punchy chapters, and each one kind of explores a different raw aspect, or not just raw. I mean, there's a lot of pain in it, inevitably, but there are a lot of crazy and funny things that happened that year, too. And it just helped me to make sense of it in the moment. And that's what I always tell people. I feel like anytime you tell a story, whether you're writing a book or just telling a story, for a group of people, you're framing it in a narrative in a way that helps you make sense out of it, at least in narrative terms. And that, for me, helps me process it. And I think that's one of the one of their true merits of storytelling, and another one being obviously that you connect with other people's stories, because the more intimately and specifically you tell your own tale, the more universal it becomes, and which is kind of one of those paradoxes, because if you go for the universal, you wind up in cliche.
Mm-hmm.
But which is why I tried to tell a story as specifically and intimately as I could, because it wouldn't have helped me. It wouldn't have helped me otherwise. And I if to the extent that the book maybe has helped a few people feel less alone, maybe that's why.
So after you wrote it and it went on sale, did people contact you and say, thanks, Amy, you helped me get through this difficult time?
Yeah. I have heard from a few people, and I've heard from a few people responding to some talks I've done that are on YouTube. And I always tell them that they help me, because it makes the world smaller. And for me to write that book and hear from someone else who connects with it in some small way, that makes me feel less alone, makes me feel less isolated. And that's true, as true now as it was then, because we have this idea that grief is linear and there's closure at the end of it, but that's not the case, you know. I'm still working through all of this, and so it still helps me to connect with people.
Yeah. You know, because I've seen you, I met you at the dinner for, where they honored Chris Capostasi, and I was sitting with all the Times Union people that night, and you all looked like you were having so much fun being there, and Chris is just a wonderful human being, so I enjoyed it, and then I ran across you in church, and then I ran across you at a neighborhood party where people were exhibiting their musical talent. I don't remember you coming that night. You kind of like get together with people and play in such a format.
Oh, yeah. I haven't gotten together with them in a while. I mean, mainly because of the pandemic. But, we've got kind of a neighborhood off and on hootenanny. It's just a bunch of friends. We get together and play a lot of music, a lot of folk and rock and other stuff. It's just we have a good time. Everything from, I don't know, Bob Dylan to the Talking Heads, actually. It's a lot of fun. And that was my first kind of, that was my first experimentation with improvising, because I had come into music via classical music, although, you know, again, I was really an amateur, but in classical you don't improvise, not nowadays. They used to in Mozart's day, but not nowadays. And so I started playing music. Then I started getting together with these friends, and in the middle, they turned to me and said, "Yeah, Amy, you know, I take it." And it's terrifying because people look at you and you go, "Oh my God, I've got to turn something around quickly. I have no idea what I'm doing." But it was as liberating as it was terrifying. And you know, playing by ear has become my mission in a lot of ways. And the way we looked at it, when my life went so completely off script when Chris died, that it's kind of become a metaphor. And that's what I love about jazz, playing jazz, is it's that terrifying leap.
Do you like classical much more than just like modern day rock? Which one do you like better?
Better? Oh, that's what I can't say. Better to me, I just love music. And you know, I wrote you don't have to know, it's like I've been out of print for decades, but I did write a a biography of Fritz Kreisler long ago, which I think 18 people read, and that's fine because, you know, that's the size of my readership when I write books. But I loved working on it. Fritz Kreisler was an amazing violinist. My mother, who was a violinist, worshipped him. And he said something that always stuck with me. It's like, people say there's good music and bad music. This is a paraphrase. I don't have it right in front of me. But it's like, if it's not good, it's not music. Like, all music is good. And I kind of feel the same way, because when I hear something that's bland and repetitive, it doesn't move me as music. But I mentioned the Talking Heads. A lot of what they do is really complex and, you know, fantastic music, a lot going on. I love Sufjan Stevens, an amazing contemporary singer-songwriter who also works as a composer. I think nowadays with contemporary classical music, there's an awful lot of overlap among the different types of music, because a lot of contemporary American and all sorts of composers around the world are writing music that's informed by jazz and rock and rap. And so I love music, and I love Sibelius, and I love Shostakovich, and I love Beethoven. And, you know, my dad was a music critic, and my mother, as I said, was a violinist. So I grew up with Bach in my ears constantly. And to me, it's just all of a piece, because that's the music I heard growing up. But I also listened to Stevie Wonder, whom I adore. I think that Songs in the Key of Life is the greatest album ever recorded. And that's all in a mash in my head. And to me, the jazz kind of is informed by all of it, because it's musically really challenging. There's a lot going on. And at the same time, it's so thrilling, because it's got this element of improvisation. So it's not either or for me. It's not like binary. I like that, I don't like that, or I like that better than that. If it's great music, I love it, and it runs the gamut.
And also, like with writing, it's creative. So, you know, you're creative on, you know, a number of fronts. You're creative with writing. You're creative with music. And, you know, what's going on? We addressed this, like, at the very beginning. You know, between the pandemic, the civil unrest, do you think there's going to be a lot of creativity, positive creativity, with artists and musicians and writers and poets? Do you think
absolutely.
There'll be a lot of that coming from this stressful time that we're living through?
Yeah. No, I've given that a little bit of thought. I wound up doing a think piece for the Times Union on it. I expect to see not just really fascinating and powerful art to come out of this era we're in, but art that's somehow changed, because periods of crisis throughout history have led to changes in art forms. It's inevitable. It's not something that can ever really be predicted, but you know, during the Black Death, the plague of the middle ages, out of that came a blossoming of secular music, like ballads, dance forms, and drinking songs. That kind of fascinates me. I actually didn't know that until I did some research for the story. But I don't know what's going to happen out of this, but I imagine that there's going to be a huge surge in really interesting art across the board, across all forms. And I don't know what that will be, but it's inevitable. Artists respond to crisis.
Oh, that's an interesting statement. Did you realize that before artists respond to crisis? Did you always feel that way, or is it something that you've realized recently?
No, actually, I've always felt that way. And you know, what's fascinating is that I've been using that word a lot in this interview, so I guess I should have a thesaurus in front of me to use other words. But it is fascinating.
And
I a couple years ago, was it last year? Last year seems like ages ago. I read a couple of books about the siege of Leningrad. And one of the books I read, one of them was I don't have them in front of me, but one of them was a novel set during the siege, and the other was a nonfiction book about Dmitri Shostakovich and all the works that he wrote during the siege, and how he was able to, how the siege affected the symphonies that he wrote. And all the fellow musicians that he lost to the siege, and the crisis during the siege, and all the people. And it was just, it's just the account of the siege itself is horrific. I mean, people resorted to literally cannibalism. It went on forever. People were starving. But Shostakovich kept at it. And the thing that fascinates me is that his music, like, you listen to it, and he's absolutely one of my favorite composers of symphonies, and you listen to the Fifth Symphony, the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony, and there's always been this conversation around Shostakovich. Well, yeah, he stayed in the Soviet Union. Was he, you know, was he a tool for Stalin? Did he actually oppose Stalin? Well, it's more complicated than that, because he was a young father, and he couldn't, first of all, he couldn't leave the Soviet Union, and secondly, he didn't want to die, so he couldn't oppose Stalin outright, and yet Stalin wound up hating him for some of the work that he wrote at the time. And so it's very complicated, but you listen to the Fifth Symphony, and there are pieces of it that sound like a military tattoo, like military music, except they're warped. And it's impossible for me not to listen to it and hear not only the situation of Shostakovich and everybody suffering in the Soviet Union during World War II, but to hear his anger at Stalin. And if I had absolutely no interest in maintaining my dignity, I would actually sing the section for you, because I have it memorized. And because every time I listen to it, it's just a fantastic piece. Every time I listen to it, I hear these horns blaring, and it's so clear that he's mocking Stalin. He's mocking the militarism of Stalin. So
I tell you what, Amy, we're almost out of time. We've got about a minute left, but
okay.
Would you come back again, and would you sing for us?
Sing.
I'll play your violin.
I'll answer the first part of your question. I would be happy to come back. That would be fun. And sure, absolutely, I could bring some music. That'd be fun.
Okay, thank you so much. So give yourself a little plug, Amy.
Okay, give myself a little plug. I'm terrible at that. Okay, anybody wants to read my book, Figuring Shit Out? And I also wrote House of Holy Fools, and you can find me on the Times Union. And listen to Gypsy Jazz. It'll make you happy.
Thank you so much, Amy. Stay well, stay safe, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.